Recently, the Well blog on the New York Times website, written by Tara Parker Pope, ran a post titled "News Keeps Getting Worse for Vitamins." The post was a roundup of the latest vitamin studies involving vitamins A, C, and E, along with beta carotene and some others, and the news wasn't good. A Harvard study showed nurses taking high doses of vitamin A were more likely to fracture their hips, and another study found no benefit of vitamin C and E for heart disease. Well, how reliable are these studies? And if the science is good, why are Americans still buying so many vitamins? Good morning to you. I'm Veronica Rickert. I'm sitting in this morning for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Well, here this morning to help us sort out the case for or against vitamin supplements is Dr. Paul Coates, the director of the Office of Dietary Supplements from the National Institute of Health. And I'm hoping you'll join us this morning as well with your questions and insight into the supplement market, the vitamin supplement market. And the number to call is 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Or you can always send us email at talk@wpr.org. And Dr. Paul Coates, thank you so much for joining us today.
Good morning. Thank you for having me on.
Well, do you agree with the headline on the Well blog on the New York Times? Is the news for vitamins, is it bad? Is it getting worse?
I don't know that it's getting worse. It's always a challenge to try to interpret studies of dietary ingredients that are provided in supplement form. There has been a lot of work done in the past that pointed to potential benefits in terms of coronary heart disease prevention, cancer prevention, and other chronic diseases. But when these interventions were subjected to what we generally believe to be the gold standard, namely randomized control trials of the interventions, the results really did not, in general, support those epidemiologic findings. So we're left with some kinds of study designs that point to benefit and other kinds of study designs, ones that we tend to rely on when thinking about the effectiveness of drugs. These studies really don't point to any benefit. So it's a mixed bag. It certainly raises questions for me about a couple of things. One, are we looking at these in the right way? And two, are people being sort of persuaded to take something that may not provide them with any benefit? I wish I could tell you and your listeners today that we have the answer, but we don't.
Well, let's talk about some of the recent studies before we get too deep into it. For instance, a large clinical trial of, I think it was almost 15,000 male doctors taking vitamins E and C for a decade, and that study showed no meaningful effect on cancer rates. Tell us about that study.
Yeah, this was called the Physicians Health Study, Phase 2, PHS-2, Randomized Controlled Trial, looking at vitamins E and C in the prevention of cancer, and in a parallel study looking at the prevention of cardiovascular disease. And I think we can sum up the results of both of those assessments, that vitamins E and C, together or alone, were not effective in reducing the risk of either cardiovascular disease or various cancers in adult men.
And have those results been duplicated?
Generally speaking, we've seen, certainly with respect to cardiovascular disease, now several studies recently, again, these are randomized controlled trials, that point to little or no observable effect on rates of cardiovascular disease. Let me pause for a second and remind you that vitamins and minerals, of course, are present in foods, and so you and I, and probably all of the men in that study, were taking vitamin supplements over and above a regular diet. If they were eating a diet that allowed them to maintain pretty normal levels of vitamin E and C in their blood, then it's possible that the additional benefit, putative benefit, of supplemental vitamins E and C would be very, very difficult to discern because the background rate would be so high. And that's actually one of the big challenges of doing studies like these. I don't know whether one would call it a placebo effect or certainly a background effect. And these are this is not the sort of thing that we see in drug trials, where you either have none or you have some given in the drug. And the chance of being able to identify a difference is probably larger under those circumstances.
Well, what about a study looking at vitamin E and selenium possibly lowering the risk for prostate cancer?
Yeah, this was a study that was mounted by the National Cancer Institute, one of the components of the NIH, along with the National Center for Complementary and Alternative Medicine. And it was following up on a very encouraging clue from a previous study that showed that selenium could very well reduce the risk of prostate cancer in at-risk men. So the NCI and NCAM, those are the acronyms for those two organizations, mounted this very large study of men. There were 30-some thousand men in the SELECT trial, is what it was called, and they were going to be followed for a period of about 7 years to look at the effect of vitamin E or selenium or both, and look at the rate of prostate cancer after the exposure. This study ended up being terminated early because it became evident during an interim analysis that there was no chance that the study would reveal either a benefit or a harm, for that matter, of vitamin E or selenium in with respect to prostate cancer. And so the study was terminated by the NCI and NCAM after considering those findings. In a nutshell, there was no evidence of a benefit of either vitamin E or selenium or the combination in preventing prostate cancer. That was kind of disappointing for those who felt that maybe this was going to be part of the way in which we could encourage men to take care of their risk for prostate cancer by taking dietary supplements like vitamin E and selenium.
What about a vitamin that does seem to be able to sort of walk the walk to match its hype, vitamin C? There were some positive findings about vitamin C, weren't there?
There had been in the past, yes. But so often, early studies, like the ones that provided clues for vitamin C, for that matter, vitamin E, and certainly some other nutrients, were based on studies done in populations where you look at, so what's the rate of a particular disease among people who have the highest levels of a particular nutrient versus those who have the lowest levels. And those kind of epidemiologic studies provide some very, very interesting clues that really must be followed up in more carefully controlled studies. As has often happened, but not always, we can get to some ones that probably have proven themselves in a bit. I think it's fair to say that even with vitamin C, in terms of the prevention of cancer, the evidence remains pretty slim.
Well, what about the vitamin C, though, being linked with less severe and shorter colds? I mean, that's almost good enough for me. I hate colds. And then also for people who engage in extreme sports, like marathon runners and skiers, that it seems to give them fewer colds when those people are taking vitamin C.
I was concentrating on the cancer side of it. And you're quite right that there is some evidence, although it's mixed, but there is some evidence that vitamin C can, as can some other dietary supplements, can reduce or ameliorate the effects of a cold. The effects are hard to tease out, as we have learned over the last several years. And it's in part because of what I mentioned earlier. We get a lot of these nutrients from our food, and it's possible, or it might be difficult, to see any additional benefit for some of these nutrients. And that's why the studies tend to be either the effect sizes are small or non-existent.
Well, you mentioned a moment ago a vitamin that has been proven to be effective, and I assume you were going to talk about vitamin D.
Vitamin D, calcium, folate probably represent different kinds of very interesting results, briefly with vitamin D, there really is no question that it reduces the risk of falls and fractures in older people. It certainly is true that vitamin D deficiency, real deficiency in infancy and childhood, is a cause of rickets, and it can be readily ameliorated by providing additional vitamin D. Beyond that, there are a number of other potentially valuable findings with respect to vitamin D that really need to be more carefully looked at. I think it's fair to say that over the last several years, we've learned a lot about vitamin D and its effects on lots of different kinds of metabolic processes, body processes. And this has led to some encouraging findings related to risk for cancers, risk for heart disease, risk for diabetes, and other potentially important chronic diseases.
Well, you're being pretty careful, but I can tell you that here on the ground, just about every woman I know is taking massive doses of vitamin D to prevent breast cancer is mm-hmm. the big one, and then another one would be to improve mood. There's been some research out there, I think, that we're just not getting enough vitamin D, and at these huge doses, 1,000, 2,000, your depression could lift, especially if you live in northern climates.
Yeah, I would say there's some potential there, but these are results that are probably pretty confounded. The fact that people are already living in an environment that makes them more prone to depression, if what the situation you've described is correct, and I have no reason to doubt it. But there are one of the things that we don't do much in the winter, in the cold months, is get out. And so we don't necessarily engage in the kind of physical activity. We may not get as much, we certainly don't get as much exposure to sun as we would during the summer months. And I think it's possible, and it's the sort of thing that can be evaluated. We get kind of what I told you before, that we get clues from observational studies, and we try to make the correct kinds of studies to be able to determine whether or not it is the vitamin D itself or vitamin D along with something else, or something else and vitamin D is being carried along for the ride. In practice, on the ground, as you say, people are encouraged by results like this, and even if all of the data are not in, they likely will want to improve their chances. You mentioned a serious life-threatening disease, breast cancer, and I think women are anxious to improve their risk or to improve their chances of not getting breast cancer by any means that are possible. And in terms of mood, there's a multifactorial disorder. Well, mood disorders are quite multifactorial, and I'm a little less inclined to ascribe all of the positive results to vitamin D exposure.
Well, talk a little bit about the findings with vitamin D and breast cancer for a moment, because there's obviously been some very encouraging studies to encourage physicians to tell their patients to start taking vitamin D. Our own Zorba Pastor here at Wisconsin Public Radio, I know, had posted the new recommendations for vitamin D. So it is something that's largely out there.
Yeah, no question. And in fact, in the last several years, let me step back for a second. Periodically, the U.S. and Canadian governments, based on reports that are developed by the Institute of Medicine here in Washington, release reports making daily recommended allowances for a host of different nutrients, including vitamin D. It's been 10 years since the vitamin D recommendations were formally completed. And in that interim, in the period between then and now, there really has been a lot of research on vitamin D and, by the way, on calcium. And so we, the governments of Canada and the United States, have gotten together to initiate a fresh review of the recommended daily intakes for vitamin D and calcium, again, with the Institute of Medicine. That report will be out in 18 months or so and should provide the basis for government-sponsored recommendations for vitamin D and for calcium. In the meantime, there are published values, and they continue to be the ones that are generally recommended. There's some leeway, of course, because even though we might have a recommended intake level of, let's say, 600 international units of vitamin D for older Americans and Canadians, the window is fairly large, so that up to about 2,000 international units per day of vitamin D, there's not believed to be any harm. Beyond that, I'm going to be cautious, because the results that were used to develop these dietary reference intakes in 1997 were based on the available evidence at the time, and they did not call for levels of intake of vitamin D above 2,000 international units per day for the general population under most circumstances. There are circumstances in which people are recommended to take larger amounts, and there are individual physicians who have somewhat more aggressive vitamin D protocols. But these are generally in people who are monitored well and who have some underlying reason to need larger amounts. For the general population, we continue to make the recommendations that we do, but as I said, the governments are in the process of getting the new data analyzed and incorporated into the new dietary reference intakes. What will change about them, I can't say. I don't know that they will change, but they will be re-reviewed.
Well, we need to take a break right now, and then we'll come back and talk more about vitamins and the latest research on the efficacy of vitamins with Dr. Paul Coates, who is a director at the Office of Dietary Supplements, the National Institutes of Health. Hoping we'll be hearing from you this morning as well with your questions and maybe your own experience using vitamins. Have you found them to be useful to you, or do you think that it's just sort of a lot of money down the drain? The number to call this morning, 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. We have an open line for you. You can also shoot us an email if you'd rather at talk@wpr.org. I'm Veronica Rickert in today for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up today on Wisconsin Public Radio, at 12:30, join us for Chapter a Day as Jim Fleming reads The Cricket on the Hearth from Christmas Books by Charles Dickens. Veronica Rickert back with you this morning on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour we're talking vitamins and the disappointing new results, most of them, about the efficacy of vitamins and why Americans keep taking them. Do you think that maybe these studies were flawed and that we need to do more research? Or if the science is good, why do you think we're still buying them? The number this morning, 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. And our guest is Dr. Coates, director at the Office of Dietary Supplements, the National Institutes of Health. And we'll go to the phones right now. We've got a call from Madeline in Waupaca. Hi, Madeline.
I can't say enough good about how much vitamin D has helped me. I have clinical depression, and I take medication for it, but it still didn't totally cover my problem. And I started taking 2,000 IUs of vitamin D daily, and in a couple of months, my depression lifted. I have a lot of energy. I get up early in the morning and stay up all day. And also, I had my two little grandsons, who are 7 and 9, tested for vitamin D, and both of them were extremely deficient vitamin D. And so I just can't say enough good about vitamin D. Thank you.
Thank you for your call, Madeline. Does that sound familiar, Dr. Coates? And if you could, to talk a little bit about vitamin D deficiency in infants and children.
Yeah. Well, it's obviously wonderful to hear a story like that, and it's great when people have can experience benefit from something that is relatively not invasive, and they can do it themselves. I'm going to insert a caution towards the end of this brief remark, though. I think it is great, and it's the sort of thing that has caused the research community to increase the kind of work that it's doing related to the potential benefits of vitamin D. One of the things that would be really interesting to know is how it works in that setting, and I have to say that at least as far as I can tell, I don't know quite why it works. And, you know, we're curious people, scientists are. We like to know the answers to things. And I do believe that there will be more work related to the role of vitamin D in depression. Now, to the caution, if somebody is taking 2,000 international units a day on a regular, continuous basis, I do strongly suggest that they do that in consultation with their doctor. While there is no evident harm associated with that degree of exposure chronically, the fact is that we may not have done studies for a long enough period of time to determine whether there are any potential harms. I personally do not think there are any, but then, you know, people like the lady who was just on the phone are making these health decisions for themselves. They don't necessarily do these in consultation with a physician. And so when we make recommendations to the general population, we take into account the fact that people are not doing this through their doctors, that they're trying to make their own health decisions. So this is the general population, and we they're public health interventions, and we want to be sure that as much as we can, we ensure the safety of the consumers. As to vitamin D deficiency in children and in infants, I think this is an issue that we thought had gone away earlier in the 20th century, simply by providing more vitamin D in the form of vitamin preparations for infants and making sure that milk was fortified with vitamin D and so on. And I think we probably did a pretty good job. I say we. I'm not trying to take credit for that. But I think that in general, that was a salutary finding. However, I think that patterns of behavior have changed over the last 20 or 30 years, particularly with respect to the activities of children. Children don't get out as much as they used to. And so there is kind of a secular change in other activities that may have caused vitamin D levels to decrease. We don't have clear and abundant evidence that they actually have, but in fact we're trying to gather that information to try to understand whether there have been changes over time with vitamin D levels and what can we do about it. But one obvious change is, as I mentioned, the fact that children are not spending perhaps as much time outdoors as they were in the mid-20th century.
And isn't it true that some pediatricians are recommending vitamin D drops for babies?
Yeah. In fact, that's always been part of the armamentarium for pediatricians. And you may know that the Canadian Pediatric Society recently made a recommendation to raise the level of intake of vitamin D in kids. And then and also the American Academy of Pediatrics has doubled the recommended their recommendation for daily intake for infants and children from 200 international units a day to 400 international units a day.
How do you test for vitamin D deficiency? Is it a blood test?
Yeah, there is a blood test that's used. It happens to measure a byproduct of vitamin D metabolism. It's called 25-hydroxy vitamin D, and it can be measured in blood. There are some questions about the reliability of the test, But more to the point, there are questions about what constitutes a level that you would accept as being deficient. Currently in the United States, the recommended, the cutoff point for deficiency is around between 25 and 28 units per milliliter of blood. Others are recommending that that level be raised so that deficiency, instead of being measured at 25 units, would be measured at 50 or 70 or 75. Those want looking at. In the meantime, I think it raises our consciousness that maybe we have to look for additional ways to improve our vitamin D status. But it's a moving target at the moment. A lot of enthusiasm, a lot of early kinds of studies. Generally speaking, they're pointing in the same direction. That's actually an encouraging finding in and of itself. That these results are moving in the same direction. But there's a lot of work still to be done, especially before public health recommendations are likely to be made by, let's say, the governments of the United States and Canada.
Another call now. We have Karen here from Milwaukee. Hi, Karen.
Hi. I appreciate this topic. I just got done taking my vitamin D. I'm taking 2,000. A friend of mine, her sister has multiple sclerosis, so she's been telling me to take vitamin D3. Like 5,000. I've been diagnosed with osteoporosis. My mother had it. She was on Fosamax. She ended up having a stroke. I went and bought my Fosamax. I had it on the dresser. I was ready to take it, and I got an article through either ARP or some older thing. I'm 54, about, you know, possible relationship to strokes. I've not taken it. I don't want to take it. It scares me to think about having a stroke. It's kind of too bad that we all get conflicting information constantly,
right?
And it gets very expensive to constantly see your doctor to have a conversation. My doctor recommended me taking Fosamax, but at this point, I'm just kind of wondering from you if you think that the vitamin D is an underlying reason for the need you were talking about before for larger amounts. You know, I'm a little reluctant to take the 5,000, but I'm lifting weights, and I'm trying to do the best I can, but this Fosamax question, you know, you start to wonder when people take all these drugs how effective they are, and then you get this other information about strokes. It's kind of scary, the conflicting information.
All right. Thank you, Karen. Dr. Coates?
Yeah, and I agree that it is difficult to deal with conflicting information. Without being facetious, I have to tell you that I deal with conflicting information all the time, and it's not a comfort. And in this context, it is. I recognize how difficult it is for consumers to deal with information that comes at them from different sides. One day something is good, the next day there's a problem with it, and then it's back in everybody's good books again later. It's not unreasonable under those circumstances that people want to explore their own options and maybe not get too involved with expensive healthcare providers. But if you're thinking about disease, and the endpoints of disease, then that's what healthcare providers are focused on. That's their job. And they, you might not agree with the outcome of the conversation with them, but in general, you'll find that they have a considerable amount of experience that you can draw on. At the end of the day, you can make your own decision, and in the case of vitamins and minerals, you can do that, as I mentioned, without even talking to your doctor. I would prefer that people do talk about their planned healthcare behaviors with their doctors, just in case. It may be that a person has concluded, based on a somewhat biased evaluation of the available information, that they're better off taking a vitamin than to be taking a drug.
Dr. And, Coates, what about the Fosamax? I haven't heard of that one before.
Well, it is a rare side effect. I'm not a physician, so I'm not able to make too many comments about this, but it is a rare side effect, and one that does give people pause to think. So if they look at two options...
You're saying strokes are a rare side effect.
Yeah.
Okay.
If they're looking at option A, an evidently effective drug in some people, but with some risks, and option B, a vitamin, which appears on the basis of a number of case reports to have some benefit and no evident side effects, well, and a lot cheaper, a consumer is almost always driven to the relatively inexpensive and presumably safer form of intervention. However, I don't think that's the entire reason for making a decision. I think you need to know everything that you should in making a healthcare decision. Because something's cheaper, because a friend has told you that it is good. Those are pieces of information, but they may not be the only pieces of information that you should use in constructing your own healthcare plan. Just to add one other point, if people are being recommended by their physician to take 5,000 IUs of vitamin D for their multiple sclerosis, that's a different circumstance from somebody who is relatively active and is trying to reduce their risk for further disease or a chronic disease that they may not yet have experienced. It's different if it's public health versus being treated for a medical condition.
Okay, thank you for your call, Karen, and a call here from Annalisa in Green Bay. Hi, Annalisa.
Hi. I have a question about the B-complex vitamins. A few years ago, I thought that was a big deal, and particularly vitamin B12 in terms of things like depression. What is the thinking on the B-complex at this point?
I'm happy to try to help you with that. You've already given a clue to the answer. B-complex includes a number of things. So there might be vitamin B12, folic acid, vitamin B6, niacin in various combinations and at various doses in B-complex-containing products. Generally speaking, the studies are still wanting. I can give you some very positive news, though, about vitamin B12. There is, particularly for older people, we get lots of vitamin B12 from our food, by the way, as we do most of the vitamins and minerals from a reasonably healthy, balanced diet. Vitamin B12 is fairly abundant in food. But one thing that happens as we get older, and I'm one of those, is that our ability to absorb vitamin B12 from food in the gastrointestinal tract is greatly diminished. And you can actually overcome that problem simply by providing additional vitamin B12 in the form of a pill, either as part of a multivitamin or as a B12, a purified B12 dietary supplement. And that's it is because there is some evidence that declining B12 levels are associated with, I'm not quite sure what functions, cognitive functions, are involved in this, but it is there is some fairly strong evidence that cognitive function can be improved by assuring that vitamin B12 status is maintained.
If it's not too personal, Dr. Coates, do you take vitamins? And if so, which ones?
It is a personal question, I'm actually fairly pleased to answer it. I take a multivitamin, and it contains the recommended daily amounts of most of the readily available dietary ingredients that you can, vitamins and minerals. And I guess I'm gonna jump and say, so why would I take it, and why would anybody else take it? And I think we have several reasons why we do this, and they come down to a very poorly defined term called insurance. I've actually never liked the term because I don't know what it means in this context, but maybe that describes me and a lot of other consumers as well, that we'd kind of like to improve our chances. I am not persuaded that taking a daily multivitamin is making a huge difference in my life, but it's essentially without harm, and I can't measure the benefit, but on balance, I'm sort of this risk benefit ratio, and I'm making the decision in favor of taking a multivitamin.
So no big vitamin D doses for you?
No,
just the multi.
Yeah.
Interesting. Is there a particular, you probably can't endorse a brand, but I mean, the question has been brought up, what about food-based vitamin sources versus, I guess, the other kind, which I can't pronounce?
They're essentially the same molecules. There might be several different natural forms of vitamin E, for example, and some of those will be present in different kinds of dietary supplement products. Likewise with B12 and folate, they might be present in different forms. They end up being essentially equivalent biologically, and that's because the metabolism of a number of these tends to be similar. That's not true for all of the ingredients, but for most of them it is. So it's not. I wouldn't endorse the notion that they are very different in foods than in dietary supplements. But one of the things that you have to keep in mind is that not everybody eats a well-balanced diet all the time. But if over a reasonable stretch of time, months, you tend to eat a balanced diet that is not high in calories and not distorted in one way or another to some kind of specialty food, then you stand a very good chance of being able to meet the recommended daily intakes of most vitamins and minerals. I think we're learning that with vitamin D, that may not be the case. I think it's in part because we have declined our exposure to the sun for very good reasons, but also for some lazy reasons. We don't get out much. We don't exercise as much as we used to. And we are certainly told that we have to be concerned about excess exposure to ultraviolet light from the sun as a cause of cancer. All of that conspires to probably mean that people are not getting the amount of vitamin D from foods alone that they likely need, and so it appears increasingly likely that vitamin D supplementation will need to be part of people's habits.
Well, we need to take another break right now, and then we'll come back and talk more with Dr. Coates, who is the director the Office of Dietary Supplements at the National Institutes of Health. And we're talking about the efficacy of vitamins, which ones work and which ones seem not to provide much benefit. And we'd love to hear from you this morning and tell us which vitamins you're taking. And if you've got questions for Dr. Coates, the number to call is 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Or you can send us email at talk@wpr.org. I'm Veronica Rickert, in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up at 11:45 today, we hope you'll stay tuned for Larry Mueller's show, as he has a delicious hour plan talking about bread making with Madison bread making instructor Paul Novak. That's Larry Mueller at 11:45. I'm Veronica Rickert, glad to be with you this morning on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking vitamins this hour with Dr. Paul Coates, the director at the Office of Dietary Supplements and the National Institutes of Health. And I want to get to an email we got. Mary in Madison writes, Sarah in Mosinee, rather, wants to know if there is a difference between plain old vitamin D and vitamin D3. Dr. Coates?
Sure. Vitamin D is a collection of molecules, just like folic acid or folate is a collection of molecules, and vitamin E is a collection of molecules that have similar biological activity. Vitamin D, the two major forms of vitamin D that we find in foods are vitamin D2 and vitamin D3. It is said that vitamin D3 has more biological activity than vitamin D2, although it depends a little bit on how you're measuring that. In any event, vitamin D3 is increasingly the one that is found in dietary supplements.
So that's the one found in supplements, but if you're looking at a vitamin, do you need to make sure you check the label that it says D3?
I'm harder to persuade that there really is a big difference between D2 and D3 in terms of their biological effect. Most dietary supplement labels, and I believe most foods that are fortified with vitamin D, like milk, do report whether it's vitamin D2 or D3. I think the practice is moving more towards D3 than D2, but I wouldn't worry about it.
Okay, and let's go back to the phones. Here's a call from Anne in Madison. Hi, Anne.
Hi. I wish that the National Institutes of Health were as concerned about the approval of new drugs, which really do have the ability to really harm people, as they are with the uselessness or usefulness of vitamins. I don't know anybody who thinks that any vitamin will cure cancer or prevent it, really. They do strengthen the liver, and the liver is the body's detoxifier. And I can understand that taking huge amounts of, say, vitamin D, which I also take, and it was originally for osteoporosis, but it's improved my mood, too. I don't take massive amounts, but I take quite a bit. And vitamin C I can detect in my body, in just a general craving for vitamin C. And we don't eat a good diet in this country. Anybody who goes to a supermarket can see that the commercial food sector is pushing all kinds of unhealthy, vitaminless food on us. So I think most people need them. But also the pharmaceutical industry has a sort of a swinging door with our federal health agencies. And I wonder who's putting the pressure on NIH to poo-poo the usefulness of vitamins. And I would assume that would be the pharmaceutical industry.
Okay, thank you, Anne. Dr. Coates.
Well, that's a fairly big assumption. It may be true, but I am not aware of it, and I run the Office of Dietary Supplements at the National Institutes of Health. As an agency, the NIH spends quite a lot of money on nutrition and the subset of nutrition, which is dietary supplements. Of course, you're right that there's a lot of investment in agents that might prove useful in disease prevention, disease treatment, but a lot of the same principles apply to trying to look at the effects of nutrients, either in foods or in dietary supplements, looking at so-called molecular targets. So what are the targets for these bioactive components? There is always a lot of tension between the food side and the drug side, but you'll remember that this is a research agency, and our funding is directed towards improving the health of the nation using whatever the mechanisms are that are available. There's a healthy component of the NIH budget that is devoted to research on nutrition and the subset of dietary supplements.
I have a couple emails here that are both asking the same question, essentially about the absorbability and dissolvability of vitamins. Is there a concern about certain vitamins being more dissolvable and therefore more absorbable than other vitamins?
It does vary some from one vitamin molecule to another. So, and it does vary some depending on which food they're derived from. But generally speaking, I'll just remind you of something that I said earlier, that if you're eating a reasonably balanced diet, then you're going to get the recommended daily allowance of most vitamins from all of the sources. You might not get it all from spinach one day, or you might get it all from spinach one day, and you might get it from liver some other day. And I'm just picking two examples to
but
show
if,
a dramatic difference.
If you're putting
difference.
Food aside, though, and you were specifically talking about the vitamin supplements, is there a particular brand or quality we should be looking for?
Well, you kind of hinted at it earlier. I'm not going to be able to make any comments about individual brands, but I can tell you that as part of the manufacturing process for dietary supplements, it is required by law that these these products, just like drug products, must follow a set of well-designed practices called good manufacturing practices. And those include things like bioavailability, dissolution, do they become readily available, and so on. So a lot of this is taken account of in the manufacture of dietary supplements.
I had a friend once whose mother was very into nutrition, and I recall once that she was doing a sort of quick and dirty test of absorbability by putting different brands of vitamins in glasses of water. Is there any truth to that? Would you be able to get a good handle on how they dissolve if you just watched which dissolve fastest in water?
I wouldn't.
I didn't think you would.
It's a little too kitchen sink for me, but you know, we're all, I said before that scientists are curious by nature. I think humans are curious by nature. They want to know things, and they'd like to be able to solve problems, and maybe that's part of the part of that behavior.
And what about coffee? Does that inhibit vitamin absorption? Do we know?
I don't know that for sure. Coffee has had a good rap, followed the next day by a bad rap, followed the next day by a good rap. I'm not aware of any well-designed studies that speak to the effect of coffee or its constituents like caffeine on the absorbability of vitamins. And if I've missed something, it's only because I don't know the answer to that one.
Okay, on to Mike in Milwaukee. Hi, Mike.
Hi. Just to I got two comments, but first, just to bounce off what you just said, I believe that the health supplement industry is unregulated, so you don't really know what you're getting at all in those bottles when you buy them. It could be more or less or none. Ginkgo biloba and other cognitive vitamins, quote unquote, are there to help you think clearer, better, longer. So do cognitive vitamins work, like ginkgo biloba, HUP A, phosphatidylserine? I mean, there's a whole list of this stuff. And as far as what the gentleman said about regulation of supplements, I don't believe it exists.
So let's go back to a couple of basic principles here. They are regulated, but they're not regulated as drugs. They're regulated as foods. And so there are a number of principal differences between how foods are regulated and how drugs are regulated. Foods are generally assumed to be safe based on a long history of human exposure. And that same set of rules applies to dietary supplements. One can argue about whether or not that's the right framework for regulating them, but that's the way it is. I did mention the issue about good manufacturing practices increasingly being applied to dietary supplement manufacture, and that should ensure that products, what they say on the label is in the bottle. You are correct that there has been a wide variability in ingredient or product content over the last 20 or 30 years. But generally speaking, that's improving, and it will improve more given the implementation of these good manufacturing practices. That's different, and that's important, but that's different from one of the things that you were asking about, and that's basically efficacy. So do they work? And in the area of cognitive function, I can give you a quick rundown on what I believe is the current situation. Ginkgo, there have been a lot of well-designed clinical trials, most of them having been done in Europe, that showed that for the treatment of cognitive decline, Alzheimer's, that there is some evidence of benefit. However, a recent study that was done under the sponsorship of the National Institutes of Health revealed that there was no benefit in terms of the prevention of Alzheimer's disease. Now, prevention and treatment may be very, very different things. And that's what people tend to have to contend with, that I hear it's good for this, and then I hear it's not. But maybe it's good for one aspect of the spectrum of disease and not for the other. Phosphatidylserine, there has really been limited research, to my knowledge, certainly limited clinical research about the effect of phosphatidylserine, and the same thing is true of huperzine A. These are promising. They should be looked at, but they should be looked at in a well-designed kind of clinical study way.
Well, Dr. Coates, thank you so much for your time this morning. We appreciate your insights and your time this morning.
Good. Well, it was a pleasure being with you. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Dr. Paul Coates, the director at the Office of Dietary Supplements at the National Institutes of Health. We were discussing a blog posting on the New York Times, the Well blog, titled News Keeps Getting Worse for Vitamins. I want to thank Brittany DeAnda for the on-air production this morning. Also, thank you to Rhonda Fanning and Carmen Jackson for producing. And if you'd like a copy of this program, you can call the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. The number again is 1-800-747-7444 and ask for program 1223E. I'm Veronica Rickert on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio, and thank you for listening.